You know, back when I was in high school, you had to take American history. How many of you had to do that? Okay, all right. You know the problem with American history in high school? 99% of the American history high school teachers are boring as dirt. That's the problem. And consequently, they never really gain the attention of the students. Our American history teacher was a fellow by the name of Ox Smith. Now, that wasn't his real name, but that's what everybody called him, Ox Smith. And he was about as boring as an ox, too, I tell you that. He what? Well, he did kind of look like one, didn't he? Yeah, he was a home. So history never captured my attention until I got into college. Now, this was secular university, not Bible college. By the time I got to Bible college, I was very fascinated by it. But we had a professor by the name of Dr. Kenyon, who taught ancient history. And that guy would walk in the classroom, and he would say to Hermina Fleming, who was a very pretty girl that sat in the front row always, and he'd say, "Now, where was I, Hermina?" And she would say, "Well, you were at," and she'd look at her notes, "you were at the Battle of Trafalgar." "Oh, yes!" Guy never had a note. Not a note, man. And he'd take off for 45, 50 minutes, whatever the class was. And I mean, that guy was rattling off names and dates and places and statistics, but he did it in such a way that it absolutely captivated your attention. It had a wide platform in that large classroom, about as wide as this, and that guy was from one end to the other, and he was shooting arrows and loading up catapults, and he was doing the whole thing and going through the battles and everything else. And boy, I mean, you know, it was better than TV, I can tell you that. And for the first time in my life, I said, you know, history's pretty interesting. Pretty interesting. A wise man once said, the only thing that men learn from history is that men don't learn from history. And there's a lot of truth to that. Isn't that so? Isn't that so? All right, last Sunday morning, I made a brief reference to the Declaration of Independence. And our patriotic forefathers mentioned 27 things in the Declaration of Independence that they thought were very grievous things that were put upon them by the King of England. And so that was their complaint, and that was their appeal. And as I indicated to you Sunday, I can identify at least 14 of those 27 things that are in existence right now on the part of our government. And if you read it, you probably could too. If I were teaching a history class, I would hand those 27 things out to my students and say, you identify how many of those things are relevant today and why, and why. That'd be a good assignment, wouldn't it? That'd be an excellent assignment. Well, the Declaration of Independence is one thing, July the 4th, 1776. However, there's a lot of events that led up to that that a lot of people don't know about. Now, a lot of folks have heard things like the Boston Massacre, and they've heard about the Field of Lexington and Concord and Bunker Hill, but they don't know anything about it, not really. And if you learned, you forgot it. Isn't that right? You forgot it. But there's an element to all that that is not contained in any of the secular history books. And that's the part that we really want to concentrate some attention on today, because there's a spiritual ingredient there that needs to be understood by God's people. And I think it's very, very important that we do understand it. You separate a people from their history, and that's been a huge effort on the part of the secularist over the last 50 years. Separate us from our history, you see. Then you don't have those foundational roots to go back to and say, but wait a minute, what about, see, what about that? We've been told a lot of lies about what our forefathers actually believed or didn't believe. And all you have to do is do a little bit of research and you can find out the truth. It's not like these things are hidden in a closet or in secret. It's just that most people never bother to take a look. That's all. Take a look. I suppose one of the great examples of American character back in the colonial days was an occasion that was called the Boston Massacre that took place on March the 5th, 1770. Now, that's 6 years before the Declaration of Independence. And there were a lot of things that took place even prior to that, but that's where we're going to launch our ship tonight, 1770. It was one particular snowy evening, and Captain Thomas Preston and a squad of British redcoats were confronted by an angry mob of patriots who were fed up with the growing presence of the English in their city. And so big chunks of ice were thrown at them, and a lot of name-calling started. And just kind of a riot took place right there. And one of the British soldiers was knocked to the ground, and a gun accidentally went off. And all of a sudden, everything went to, it went to hell in a handbasket is what it did, you know. And the result of that is 5 Americans were killed, and two of the British were slightly wounded. Now, but the British soldiers were arrested, put in a Massachusetts jail, and had to go to trial. Now, here's what's fascinating about that, talking about American character. Sam Adams kept the city all stirred up in a frenzy. You know, he was one of the real rebels. And he was stoking the fire every time he got a chance. But none other than Sam's cousin, John Adams, defended the British soldiers. He was their defense attorney, and with the assistance of another attorney called Josiah Quincy Jr., another patriot. Well, Preston was acquitted in front of a colonial jury, and 6 of the men were declared not guilty. 2 were convicted of minor manslaughter charges and given very light sentences. Now, here's what's fascinating about that. People would say, well, if there was such a frenzied crowd about all this, how did these guys get acquitted of those charges that were against them? Well, if you examine the thing under the searchlight of common sense, the incident tells a great deal about the American Revolution and the leaders who nursed it into a proposition and beginning. There was at this time a great emotional outcry against the British that had been increasing and intensifying for several years prior to that. But be that as it may, the Americans had a real sense of fairness and justice. Now, the gentleman who represented these guys, Mr. Adams, John Adams, you'd say, well, boy, he must have been a hated individual after that. Well, shortly thereafter, he ran for colonial assembly, and he was elected by 80%. So the people did have a sense of real fair-mindedness. Now, it was about this particular time that a very famous evangelist by the name of George Whitefield was preaching. Now, George was an English evangelist. He was not an American, but he did a lot of evangelistic work all the way from New England clear down to Georgia, up and down the East Coast, up and down the East Coast. And this guy was a good friend of John Wesley, even though they disagreed vehemently on some of their theology. Wesley was an Armenian. He was one of the founders of the Methodist movement. And Whitefield was a Baptist and considered to be a Calvinist. One of their big differences was the security of the believer, you see. But setting that aside, these guys were close friends. And they'd write letters to each other, haranguing each other over their bad theology, you know. But they both had a heart for souls. See, that was the common denominator that brought them together. They loved souls and wanted to win souls to Christ. Well, George Whitefield, 6 months after this historic riot called the Boston Massacre, entered into Boston, and this was the last time that he would have the opportunity to give Boston any encouragement or cheer. But here's what he wrote to a friend on September the 23rd. He said, I quote, "Poor New England is much to be pitied. Boston people most of all. How falsely misrepresented. What a mercy that our Christian character cannot be dissolved. Well, what was he talking about? He was talking about the character that was demonstrated at the trial of those soldiers. That was just nothing but pure character, folks. All animosity and prejudice set aside, just character. Exactly 1 week after expressing those pro-American sentiments, Whitfield died and went to heaven. And so they buried him right here, and he wanted to be buried under the pulpit of the Newburyport Church. That's where they buried a lot of the old preachers, under the pulpit. You remember what Linda wants to do? She just wants to stuff me and sit me in the corner. Yeah. Well, as Whitfield's body was being lowered into the burial vault, Reverend Jedediah Jewett charged the attending preachers and ministers that they should endeavor to follow his blessed example. And it was a revived American clergy that provided the greatest impetus for the events that were about to take place. You know what the British called most of the Protestant clergy in America at that time? They referred to them as the rebel parsons. The rebel parsons was the title that the British put on them. Well, the pulpits of the land were kindled with the flame of their own with even a greater intensity. Now, one of the great historians of that era, J.T. Headley, enlightens us accordingly. Here's what he said. I quote, "It must be remembered that the newspapers at that day were a novelty and ideas were not so easily decimated as now. The pulpit, therefore, was the most direct and effectual way of reaching the masses." People got more information by going to church. They didn't have Fox News. They didn't have very many newspapers. And so they went to church. And many of the preachers, in fact, probably the majority of them, were as much statesmen as they were preachers. They were real students of politics, human rights, etc., etc. Headley goes on to say, clergymen, now I'm just quoting a historian here, this isn't my opinion, this is his, were treated with the kind of reverential regard that Americans refused to give kings and Anglican bishops. James Adams cites 19th century historian William Sprague's description of the almost electrifying effect the entrance of the minister and his family into the meeting house had on the congregation as follows. I want you to get a load of this. This is really far out, man. I've been thinking a lot about this. I'm messing with you, right, Harry? Yeah. But here's what William Sprague's description of the entrance into the church house by the pastor. Now, of course, this is a guy that was writing this well over 100 years ago, much closer to the events than now. And here's what he said. I quote, "The whole space before the meeting house was filled with a waiting, respectful, and expecting multitude." And multitude is probably correct because most folks went to church in those days. And the church house was always full. Sometimes running over, see? It's not like today where most folks don't go to church. They did. "At the moment of the service, the pastor issued from his mansion with Bible and manuscript sermon under his arm, with his wife leaning on one arm, flanked by a Negro man on his side, and his wife was by her Negro woman. The little Negroes being distributed according to their sex by the side of their respective parents." Now keep in mind, these aren't slaves. This is New England. These are paid servants, is who these black folk are that he's talking about. Then followed every other member of the family according to age and rank, making often with family visitants somewhat of a formidable procession. So it's a whole procession that comes down the center aisle of the church house. As soon as it appeared, the congregation, as if moved by one spirit, began to move toward the door of the church. And before the procession reached it, all were in their places. As soon as the pastor entered the church, the whole congregation rose and stood until the pastor was in the pulpit and his family were seated, until which was done, the whole assembly continued standing. At the close of the service, the congregation stood until he and his family had left the church before anyone moved toward the door. Forenoon and afternoon, the same course of proceeding was had, expressive of the reverential relation in which the people acknowledged that they stood before their clergymen. Now, the historian goes on to say, although commanding the respect of his office, this man did not expect anyone to kiss his big toe. The reader will also note the presence of two other non-Catholic clerical distinctions. Bible in one hand, wife in the other. Bible in one hand, wife in the other. Well, all of that to demonstrate that the clergy of the colonial days had a tremendous influence in disseminating information that people received concerning their politics, et cetera, et cetera. We'll get more into that in a little while. You'll see that. Another big thing that was propagated by the clergy was what they called weekly State of the Union sermons. Some of the few existing newspapers that did exist would print a sermon by one of the local pastors every week in the local newspaper. And it was usually a sermon with a political bias connected to it. And then they always printed, not only in the newspaper, but in pamphlet form and distributed it throughout the community, what were called Election Day sermons. If you were to go to the Library of Congress to this day, you could find in there multitudes of Election Day sermons that were preached all over colonial America during that particular time frame. And so these preachers would preach whatever they thought was right. And the people listened very, very carefully to them. Headley, one of the historians, says this: the preachers did not confine themselves to a dissertation on doctrinal truths, nor mere exhortation to godly behavior. They grappled with the great question of the rights of man, and especially the rights of the colonist, in their controversy with their mother country. Headley also points out that their messages were not the kind of sermonettes for Christianettes. I like that. They weren't sermonettes for Christianettes. It wasn't just this fluffy little feel-good stuff, you know. It was stuff that was geared and built to really inspire people to do some serious thinking. You know, not just, oh, I go to church just so I can walk out the door and feel good. You know, no, let's do some serious thinking here, you know. Let's ponder this. Profound thought and unanswerable arguments found in those sermons show that the clergy were not a whit behind some of the ablest statesmen in their day in their knowledge of the great science of human government, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So these sermons were regularly published in one form or another, either in pamphlets or newspapers, and widely distributed, and that was the primary source of political information. Now, you know, tragically, and I do mean tragically, most pastors today in America are totally oblivious and ignorant of this part of our history. They don't know a thing about it. And I've been confronted with some of them, you know, because I've always been somewhat of a political animal, by saying, well, you know, we just don't think the church ought to be in politics. And my response to that, among others, is this. Well, now, wait a minute. Let me show you some areas in which the primary political movement for independence in the revolutionary days found its impetus in the pulpits of America. Now, if it was wrong for those preachers to participate in that kind of activity, is it wrong for us to enjoy the freedom that they secured for us? One must go with the other, wouldn't you think? So, one can appreciate Mr. Headley's likening of these election year sermons to the hands of a clock, which he does. And as you watch how the thing progressed from 1770 forward, and some of the text that these preachers use. Now, on an annual basis, a particular pastor was chosen to preach to the colonial assembly, which included all the British-appointed magistrates and the British governor. And so these preachers would preach to that whole crowd, you see. It'd be like preaching to a combined session of Congress today. And you think Congress would put up with that? All right, now, for example, in 1774, the Reverend Samuel Cook of the Second Church of Cambridge chose 2 Samuel 23, 3 and 4 as his text. Here's what the text says. He that ruleth over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God. And he shall be as the light of the morning when the sun riseth, even a morning without clouds, as the tender grass springing out of the earth by clear shining after rain. These are the kind of texts that these guys were habitually referring to when they preached to these political assemblies. Things were obviously heating up a bit by the time the Reverend Gad Hitchcock of Pembroke preached on May the 25th, 1774, from Proverbs 29:2. It says, "When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice, but when the heathen or when the wicked bear rule, the people mourn." Now, there was a governor, a British-appointed governor, and he was British, of course, himself. By the name of Hutchinson at that particular time. And that was the last sermon he ever heard on American soil. The one that Hitchcock preached. And boy, I tell you what, it's a scather. It's a barn burner, what that guy preached. I'm not going to read you even the I got the last couple paragraphs. But let me read you the last sentence. King George may say the evils that produce this state of things are imaginary, but I tell you, and I tell the tyrant to his face, it is because the wicked bear rule. Without apology. You see what he's doing? He's pointing his finger straight at the king and saying he's wicked. And he's ruling, and that's why the people mourn. Well, Thomas Hutchinson, on June the 1st, got on the ship Minerva, and he sailed back to England. He was recalled. And as the ex-governor sailed out of Boston, the harbor closed ominously behind him with the implementation of the notorious Port Act the same day, diverting all commercial shipping to the new customs office at Plymouth. Lieutenant General Thomas Gage was now in charge by mid-June, and an additional 4,000 redcoat soldiers were on hand to assist him. The handwriting was on the wall. So what took place next? The First Continental Congress met in Philadelphia from September the 5th through October the 26th, 1774. Now, we're still 2 years in front of the Declaration of Independence, you see. And was appropriately opened. Now, here's how they opened the Continental Congress in 1774. They opened it with a scripture reading from Psalm 35. Here's the scripture. Plead our cause, O Lord, with them that strive with me. Fight against them that fight against me. Take hold of the shield and buckler and stand up for mine help. Draw out also the spear and stop and the way against them that persecute me. Say unto my soul, I am thy salvation. Now, with the reading concluded, the honorable members of Congress knelt in prayer, and the presiding minister then led this assembly in prayer. Having got down to business, it was determined after 7 exhausting weeks of them meeting as a Continental Congress that a petition of colonial grievances backed by a threat of embargo should be sent to George III with dispatch. And so they did. They put together this list of grievances. This is not the Declaration of Independence, just a list of grievances, and sent it across the ocean, and it was summarily disregarded. You know, they didn't, you know, those hillbillies over there, what do they know? They don't know anything. Well, Virginia's Revolutionary Convention met at St. John's Church in Richmond on March the 20th, 1775, to ratify the recommendations of the Philadelphia Assemblage that we just talked about. Now, here it gets pretty fascinating to me. I don't know if it does to you, but it does to me. Well, the majority there were, you know, trying to figure out what in the world they ought to do, and some of them were kind of complacent about the whole thing. Patrick Henry changed all of this with one speech. Now, men like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson were sitting right there on the edge of their pews, listening to Patrick Henry. But what a lot of them did not know and did not understand, that Patrick Henry himself was carrying an extra weight of burden on his own particular soul. Not only was he looking at the of the incredibly difficult situation that his beloved country was in, but perhaps God had given him even a deeper insight. For his own beloved wife, Sarah, the mother of his 6 children, at that very moment that Henry was given the speech, was bound up in a straitjacket, having threatened suicide due to total mental insanity. Within a year, she was dead. So, another historian by the name of Langeth transports us to a pew of our own to catch the dramatic conclusion. Here's what Mr. Langeth said, and he was relatively close to the action chronologically. He said, Henry had begun calmly, but his voice rose, tendons in his neck were standing out white and rigid. He said that if the colonists wished to be free, they must fight. I repeat, sir, we must fight. An appeal to arms and to the God of hosts is all that is left to us. They tell us, sir, that we are weak, unable to cope with so formidable an adversary. But when shall we be stronger? Will it be next week or next year? Will it be when we are totally disarmed and when a British guard shall be stationed in every house? They were not weak, Henry said. 3 million people armed in the holy cause of liberty and in such a country as this, which we possess, are invincible to any force which our enemy can send against us. Besides that, they have no choice. The war is inevitable. Let it come. Repeat, sir, let it come. As Patrick Henry turned his eyes around the church, men leaned forward in their seats. Gentlemen may cry, peace, peace. But there is no peace. The war has actually begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north will bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms. Our brethren are already in the field. Why should we be idle here? What is it that gentlemen wish? What would they have? Patrick Henry's shoulders sank. He crossed his wrist as though he were the one in a straitjacket. Is life so dear, he asked, or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? He paused. He raised his eyes and lifted up his hands, still held together. Forbid it, Almighty God. Henry turned to stare at the men who opposed him. Slowly he bowed his body down. I know not what course others may take. He rose and straightened his full height, and his next words came from between clenched teeth. But as for me, give me liberty. He paused to let the word die away. His left hand fell to his side. His right hand formed a fist as though it held a dagger, and he struck that fist to his heart and said, "Or give me death." There was no applause, only silence. That's all there was, silence. Now, it was that speech that probably was one of the prime motivators in instigating some things in response to what took place. It only took 30 days for Henry's spiritual premonition to be confirmed. At approximately 1 a.m. on the 19th of April, a loud knock was heard on the door of a country parsonage. As the door swung open, Paul Revere strode into the presence of Sam Adams, John Hancock, and Reverend Jonas Clark, pastor of the Congregational Church at Lexington, Massachusetts. His report of 700 approaching redcoats was met with a certain degree of great excitement. Now, you can appreciate the fact. So they hastily called a council together and determined what they would do. The question of the hour was whether or not the people would fight. Would these humble farmers and mill hands dare resist the greatest professional army in the world at that time? In a recounting of Pastor Clark's pastoral patriotism, Headley states, quote, "Earnestly yet without passion, he discussed from the pulpit the great questions at issue. And that powerful voice thundered forth the principles of personal, civil, and religious liberty, and the right of resistance in tones as earnest and as effective as it had been the doctrine of the salvation by the cross." Well, some of them were convinced that the redcoats would be showing up about 2 o'clock, so they rang the church bells, and people were jarred out of their sleep, and they assembled on the lawn of the church under the leadership of a 45-year-old militia commander, Captain John Parker. And they hung around for a while, and no redcoats showed up, so he said, "Well, go home, but be alert." Well, at 4:30, the bells rang again, and they all piled out. And sure enough, the approaching columns of seasoned British Marines were advancing ever nearer. Captain Parker assembled his meager force of 77 men in 2 ranks. A palsied Sam Adams prevailed upon Hancock to retire with him, as their cabinet positions necessitated that they avoided being captured at all costs. However, Pastor Clark would fight along the side of his people. And he did. Another historian, Bancroft, states, you know, it's fun sorting through some of these old historians. You learn some stuff. You know, you learn stuff that's not on the History Channel. Imagine that. Bancroft said this, I quote, "Among the most alert was the minister with gun in hand, his powder horn and pouch of balls slung over his shoulder." My kind of preacher, too. By his sermons and his prayers, he had so hallowed the enthusiasm of his flock that they held the defense of their liberties a part of their covenant with God. His presence with arms strengthening their sense of duty. Under the eye of the minister, Lexington Common was alive with the Minutemen. Well, outnumbered 10-1. 10-1. Captain Parker had ordered his men to allow the redcoats to pass by unmolested, yet with the manly stipulation, "Stand your ground, don't fire unless fired upon. But if they mean to have a war, let it begin here." Led by a British commander, Major John Pitcairn, he came and shouted at the patriots from his steed, "Disperse, you blankety-blank rebels. Lay down your arms." Well, they indignantly complied with the first order only. They separated to allow this procession of British Marines through, but they would not lay down their arms. Well, some unidentified participant, probably a nervous trigger finger, let off a volley, and all of a sudden, everything went crazy. And it was all said and done. 8 Americans lay dead or dying on the ground. 2 British Marines slightly wounded. And so the Brits gave expressions of exuberance and 3 cheers and all that stuff. And on they marched. And, of course, where they were going was to Concord. And the reason they were going to Concord, their mission was to find, the objective was, destroying the town's munition reserves. For they had received word that there were some patriots in the Concord area that had stored up a lot of guns and ammunition, powder, so on. And so the expedition commander, Colonel Francis Smith, returned his march toward Concord. And so that was about another 5-mile trip down the trail. And, of course, they vastly outnumbered the Concord militia. And when the Concord militia discovered that they were coming, they withdrew to higher ground all around that particular area. Smart. It didn't take the Patriots very long to figure out that the old European way of war wasn't smart. You know, you line up your guys here and they line up their guys there and you just shoot at each other. That's not... So they came to that conclusion fairly quickly. This is dumb, you know. So they retreated to the trees and the higher ground. Now, once again, and here's the salient point as far as I'm concerned, it was the local parson who steadied their resolve for a righteous scrap. Reverend William Emerson exhorting, "Let us stand our ground. If we die, let us die here." Well, the British got to town, and they thought they were occupying this rebel town of about 1,500 people. And while the privates and the sergeants were sent out to explore the surrounding area looking for these hidden munitions, Pitcairn and Smith were sitting in chairs out on the lawn eating their breakfast of meat and potatoes and stirring their bourbon and water with their finger. And Pitcairn was noted to have said, "Before the day is over, I'm going to be stirring Yankee blood." What he didn't know about that time, 400 grim-faced musket-toting farmers were on their way. And they were moving to cross the old North Bridge. Despite the presence of 3 companies of marine defenders. When 20 British guns suddenly discharged an opening volley that led to the killing of 2 militia officers, Major Buttrick gave the command for which the Minutemen had been waiting. "Fire, fellow soldiers, for God's sake, fire!" And they did. And they did. And they did. In addition to the immediate 3 direct kills, a Patriot eyewitness reported, 8 or 10 were wounded and are running and hobbling about and looking back to see if they were after them. The battle lasted all of 2 minutes. Now, the British had no idea how many adversaries were out there because they weren't all lined up like a bunch of dummies. They were hidden behind the trees and the rocks and in the ditches, and they were firing at will at these Brits who were all of a sudden stumbling around, some of them wounded, some of them dead, and so they began to retreat all the way back to Boston. A 5-mile, 2.5-hour turkey shoot ensued. Because what the Patriots did was they just ran alongside the road up in the bushes and the trees and the rocks and the rills, and they would stop and they would load. And they, I mean, you ever load a, yeah, I mean, that's, I got an old flintlock I was thinking about bringing in and demonstrating, you know, what's involved in just loading that puppy, you know. And they would load, they would run a little further down the road and shoot, run a little further, load, run down the road and shoot. And they followed the Brits all the way back to Boston, shooting them as they went. Had it not been for Lord Perry's 900 reinforcements at Lexington, he saved the force from total annihilation. Major Charles Stedman, a contemporary British officer and celebrated military historian, described the scene on the very ground of their earlier short-lived celebration accordingly. Percy now formed his detachment into a square in which enclosed Smith's party, who was so exhausted with fatigue that they were obligated to lie down for a rest on the ground, their tongues hanging out of their mouths like those of dogs after a chase. That was one Brit describing the rest of the Brits. See? All right. Now, so as they were retreating back to Boston, church bells were just ringing all the way back, which was calling the Patriots to attention. Now, when it was all said and done, while these inexperienced greenhorn colonial volunteers had suffered 49 killed, 39 wounded, and 5 missing in action, the seasoned British grenadiers, fusiliers, and marines had sustained numbers 3 times as high. 73 killed, 174 wounded, and 26 missing. So on the heels of these two historic battles, Lexington, Concord. I'm sure you've heard of Lexington and Concord, but did you know what happened, see? Did you know what happened? The Second Continental Congress convened at the Pennsylvania State House on May the 30th, 1775. The great topic of discussion was the formation of a Continental Army. See, at that point, they didn't have an army. Yeah, these were just militia, minutemen, volunteers, people protecting their own homes and livelihoods. That's all they were. And they seemed to be reasonably effective. And then immediately after that, word came that Fort Ticonderoga had surrendered. You know where Fort Ticonderoga is? Have you ever been there? It's up on Lake Champlain between New York and Vermont. Well, as a result of Fort Ticonderoga being, I have to slow down to say that. That's quite a mouthful. Ticonderoga. They captured 59 cannons, which was a real help to the colonialist right there. All right, now, while these events were transpiring, the siege of Boston was underway with General Gage and his entire army hemmed in by several thousand angry patriots. Now, all of a sudden, the patriots were getting fired up. You know what we need in America? Fired up patriots. Fired up patriots. And at this point, I don't even think we need guns and bullets. We just need a lot of people that are upset enough to say enough is enough. You know? Now, so the word leaked out that Gage intended to gain an artillery advantage by securing the adjacent Dorchester Heights. So the Americans decided to beat him to the punch. And so they said, well, we're going to claim the high ground. And some thought that Bunker Hill was the highest ground available. And so they said, let's go to Bunker Hill. And so they were sneaking down on the evening of June the 16th with about 900 colonial troops under the command of Colonel William Prescott. They assembled at Cambridge and were led in solemn prayer by Dr. Samuel Langdon, who was, of all things, at that time, president of Harvard University. You think whoever is president of Harvard today knows how to pray? Harvard University. You realize that Harvard and Yale were schools that were started for the primary purpose of training preachers. That was their foundation stones, you see. All right, now, so he led them in prayer. And afterwards, these 900 colonial soldiers marched by lantern light to the base of Bunker Hill, only to pass by it for a lower hill called Breed's Hill. And so they got up on Breed's Hill, and Prescott directed his men in hasty construction of a primitive fort of earth and timber. And so they were digging and digging and digging, and by 3:30 a.m., the angled redoubt supporting 136-foot sides with ramparts 5 and 6 feet in height were still only partially completed. I mean, these guys were digging like gophers, you know, out there all night long trying to build some kind of a protection on Breed's Hill. At first light, Gage and his fellow generals were astounded at what they saw. And so what they ordered was artillery shells from cannon on the ships in the harbor to be aimed and directed at this depository of colonial soldiers. And for a while, it was pretty effective. I mean, they were blowing bits and pieces up out there on that hill, you see, with nothing but cannon fire from all these naval artilleries out in the harbor. But for some reason that demonstrates how much God was in this thing, they stopped. And one of the reasons they stopped was the tide was going out. And the tide was abnormally low. And they realized that and said, we've got to go out to sea. Out of range. I wonder who controls the tides. Who controls the tides? Well, let's do a circle the wagon here for a minute. A gentleman by the name of David Avery of Norwich, Connecticut, was one of those many thousands of impressionable youths who went to hear George Whitefield. And out of curiosity only, but he got under such conviction of the Holy Spirit that he got saved, listening to Whitefield preach. Having surrendered to the ministry, Avery graduated from Yale College, back when Yale College was a seminary or Bible college, you see, and was subsequently ordained in 1773. He later moved to Gainesboro, Vermont, and assumed the pastorate of a local congregational church. Now, you have to understand, congregational churches were considerably different in those days than they are today. Now, when news of Lexington and Concord reached his sleepy community, Pastor Avery shocked his flock by resigning his position to join the army as a chaplain. As he marched out of town for Boston, 20 of his former parishioners, having chosen him as their captain, followed closely behind with muskets on their shoulders. When the little band arrived on Cambridge on April the 29th, the troops assembled to receive the Reverend Captain and his men, as they were referred to. On the morning of the battle of Bunker Hill, which was really Breed's Hill, Chaplain David Avery performed a most unusual service for his country. Historian Headley describes the holy scene. Here's the description. In the Battle of Bunker Hill, as it is called, but which is well known took place on Breed's Hill, this brave, godly man stood on Bunker Hill in full sight of the conflict. And as Moses, who stood on the hill and held up his hands that Joshua might smite the Amalekites, so he with the adjacent heights and shores were shaking to the thunder of cannon, and the flames of burning Charlestown were rolling heavenward, lifted up his hands and prayed that God would give victory to the Americans. Breed's Hill, dimly seen through the rolling smoke of battle, amid which flashed the deadly volleys and gleamed the glittering lines And in the background, this patriotic divine with upraised hands beseeching heaven for victory would make an appropriate picture of that bloody prelude to the revolution. Now, it was this young preacher that gave the inspiration for those retreating patriots who began to realize all of the bulwark that they had tried to construct overnight was being decimated to stay instead of retreat. And so they stayed looking over at Bunker Hill and just watching that preacher pray. That was the primary motivator for them. Here, years later, Reverend Avery's personal diary for June the 18th was discovered. And here's what he said. This is what he wrote in his own hand. I stood on a neighboring hill, Bunker, with hands uplifted, supplicating the blessings of heaven to crown our unworthy arms with success. To us infantile Americans, unused to the thunder and carnage of battle, the flames of Charleston before our eyes, the incessant play of cannon from their shipping from Boston, and their wings in various cross directions, together with the fire of musketry from more than four times our number, all heightened the majestic terrors of the field, exhibiting a scene most awful and tremendous. But amid the perils of the dread encounter, the Lord was our rock and our fortress. About 3 o'clock that afternoon, the British decided that they were going to use an infantry frontal attack. They believed that most of the patriots had deserted and left. And so they said, we're going to march right up Breed's Hill, and we're going to go over those ramparts, and we're going to destroy whatever remains. Now, the officer in charge made an admonition to the men, which has kind of become popularized over the years. He said, men, stay down and don't shoot till you can see the whites of their eyes. And so, there they are, hunkered way down there. And here come these British. You know how they do. They march up side by side, shoulder to shoulder, up the hill. They're coming. Ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom. You know, fife and drum are playing. Ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom. And here they come up the hill. And when they were about 100 feet away, and you could see the whites of their eyes, about 200 flintlocks came over that thing and fired all at once. And I mean, it caused such havoc, and bodies were rolling all over the place and rolling downhill and dead and screaming and wounded. And, of course, the British instantly retreated, and down the hill they went. And it wasn't but about an hour later, not too bright, they sent a second detachment. Same way, right up the hill. Here they come. Well, it doesn't take an hour to reload a flintlock, I can tell you that. Same thing all over again. Kablooey, down the hill they go. Third time, same thing. Three times they marched these men into this horrible arena of destruction. But after the third time, the militiamen were out of powder. Out of powder. So they gradually retreated, knowing that they had nothing left to defend themselves with. And so the British finally came over the rampart and declared, oh, we have now the victory. But even General Gage admitted in later conversation that it was no victory at all. None whatsoever. As the sweat-drenched Reverend Avery descended Bunker Hill at the conclusion of his prayer meeting for America, the extent to which the Lord answered would not be fully appreciated for many years to come. Not only did the colonial soldiers receive an infusion of confidence for the struggles that lay ahead, but the British gained a healthy respect for their unpolished American cousins as well. Although the enemy occupied the opponent's fortress at day's end, the triumph was an empty victory at best, with, on the British side, 1,054 dead and wounded to be cared for. Compared to only 449 American casualties, it was no time for cheers or shouts for what took place at Lexington. But the point that I'm really trying to get across here, and if you're interested, we're just getting started. We can continue this next week. You want another history lesson next week? It was the spiritual bulwark of colonial America that incited the fight for freedom that you and I enjoy today. Now, in the early days, there was no one, not statesmen, not politicians, not preachers, that really wanted to separate from England. There was no desire to separate from England. They wanted to be treated as equal British citizens. That's all they desired. But the abuses were so grievous that finally they said, as indicated in the Declaration of Independence, there comes a time when you have to dissolve these political bands. And that's where our history lies. That's where our history lies. Well, if we continue next week, and I guess we will, I think what I want to talk to you about next is a lot of things you may not know about George Washington. You ever heard of a man by the name of Gano, G-A-N-O? Probably haven't, have you? Gano. You know who Gano was? For a while, he was the pastor in New York City, and he was George Washington's pastor. Gano baptized George Washington in the Hudson River. Now, they won't tell you that in any secular history book, will they? No, they wouldn't want you to know that. There are a lot of things they don't want you to know, but we'll tell you. We'll let you in on some of the good stuff. You get the good stuff here. So, for people to say, as President Obama has declared, America is not a Christian nation, and he said it. That is one of the most insane comments that's ever been made. America was bathed and founded on Christian principles and biblical doctrines. He even said that the Muslims contributed greatly to the foundation of this country. I'm still looking for one contribution. I haven't found one yet. This whole thing is built on biblical truth, ladies and gentlemen, and we're just scratching the top of the iceberg on that so far. But occasionally, I wrestled with this. I said, Lord, do I teach our folk a history lesson about those particular days? But then it's almost as if the Lord said to me, where else are they going to get it? Yeah, well, Linda said to me as I was reading to her yesterday, I guess, Patrick Henry's speech. And she said, a few years ago, you'd just thought, well, okay, that's good. But right now, it's becoming increasingly sobering. Is it not? Increasingly sobering. And if God's people don't know it, who is gonna tell anybody else? Well, okay. Yes, sir. Yeah, Fort Ticonderoga. I've been there. I've toured the place. And by the way, global warming. In 1770, one of these years that we've been talking about, it was in the 1770s. I can't remember exactly which year. Lake Champlain was a huge lake. never thawed out all summer long. All summer. Frozen all summer. You know why I said that? Just to show you. Weather is cyclical. It's cyclical. And so we all know that. Maybe we're back in the rain cycle. Wouldn't that be a blessing? Wouldn't that be a terrific blessing? All right, yes, sir. I don't remember, Matt, whether that's true or not. And they were called the Green Mountain Men from Vermont. I just couldn't remember who led them. The Green Mountain Boys, wasn't that it? Yeah, yeah. My kind of guy, man. Yeah. Well, you know, Bible-believing preachers haven't always been lace on the underwear, milquetoast wusses. There have been some men of men in those rank and files, I can tell you that. And thank God for them. We'll study several more. There was a lot of preachers that joined the chaplaincy of the Continental Army voluntarily. And that's when the British really, that's when they started calling them the rebel parsons, you know, because they realized that it was these pastors that were providing the encouragement and the impetus for the colonialists to continue to fight. It wasn't coming from politicians. You know, if there's going to be any impetus for any kind of real change in America today, it's not going to come from the politicians. The Republicans are just about as corrupt as the Democrats. It's got to come from the pulpit. The problem is the pulpit's not much better, and the church houses are empty. So there you go. But yeah, we do. Yeah, that's a good point, Paul. All right, well, enough is enough. I think there's a cake or something out there. Is that right, Harry? Yes, sir. You remember when Louis Farrakhan had his so-called Million Man March in Washington? We need a million-man march of American Christian patriots in Washington, D.C. You know, we don't need guns or anything else. We just need to stop traffic. Yeah.